Well, we're finished going through Paul's letter to the Philippians. I am going to begin a new series, but I'm going to do so next week. This morning is a one-off sermon, and you may have seen then on the slides as you were coming in that the title for this sermon is The God of a Great Heart. The God of a Great Heart. Those aren't my own words. They're from a sermon by Charles Spurgeon. And if you're struggling to understand what he means by the God of a great heart, listen to a couple of sentences leading up to that phrase in the sermon. This is what Spurgeon says. He says, "The God in whom some believe is unable to feel. They lay it down in their theology as an axiom that God cannot feel. This, however, I take leave to deny. I cannot regard God as though he were a block of wood or a mass of iron, unable to feel. On the contrary, he is represented to us as greatly feeling, the God of a great heart." So now hopefully you get the meaning of Spurgeon's phrase, God feels. God is an emotional being. In that sense, he's the God of a great heart. Now, in this month's Evangelical Times, there's an article which presents a very different kind of God. This article presses God's unchanging faithfulness, which of course is a wonderful truth, and Tom reminded us of it on Wednesday evening, but this article presses God's unchanging faithfulness to such an extreme that God, it says, can't respond emotionally to anything, because that would involve change. If a particular feeling were ever aroused in his heart, then in that moment, he would have undergone some change, some variation, some fluctuation. That cannot possibly be. That is the general drift of the article. Now, that denial of God's emotions produced some quite strong emotions in me, mainly horror. And I immediately knew then that I wanted to preach this morning on the God of a great heart. It's not that I have anything novel to say on the subject. Some of you will remember that Alan preached on it helpfully a year or two ago, and indeed he has written a couple of articles in Evangelical Times arguing for an emotional God. So much of what I'll say will probably overlap with that material, but I'm of the view that this cannot be stressed too often. It isn't a minor, hair-splitting matter. I mean, I'm always reading things in Christian magazines that I don't agree with. I don't normally feel the need to preach a sermon tackling the wrong view that I've read. But this is different. This article isn't just wrong, it's dangerously wrong. It's promoting something that I don't even recognize as biblical Christianity. And some of you then may read it, and others of you may at some point come across the same kind of material elsewhere. So I want to make sure that you're unscathed. I would hate to think of anyone at NREC living the Christian life all along, imagining God to be the emotionless being that he's presented as in this article. And so then, there are three very simple things that I want to say to you this morning. And first of all, this. The Bible offers a genuine revelation. The Bible offers a genuine revelation. One of the subheadings in the article almost beggars belief. It boldly announces impassibility. Impassibility is the fancy term for this idea that God can't experience emotion and can't suffer. Impassibility helps us understand Scripture. If there's one thing it emphatically doesn't do, it's help us understand Scripture. On the contrary, this view of God set forth in the article, it requires you to be constantly performing mental gymnastics whenever you're reading Scripture. Okay, so this passage here, it records God responding to a particular situation with a particular emotion, but I know he's not really doing that because in actual fact, he's emotionless. And this passage describes God in a certain set of circumstances, feeling a certain way. But I know that's not literal, because in actual fact, God doesn't experience feelings. And so it goes on page after page of the Bible, this constant, it says that, but in actual fact. It says that, but in actual fact. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not a fundamentalist. I don't read everything in the Bible, taking it woodenly at value. I know that, like all great literature, the Bible features symbolism and metaphor and hyperbole and euphemism and all that kind of stuff. I get that. I get that when the Bible speaks of God's arm or God's hand or God's eyes or God's ear, we're not meant to think of these giant physical organs of his, kind of composed of skin and blood vessels. I get that. But when someone says to me, you should treat references to God's emotions the same way you treat references to God's organs, I have a problem. And it's this. I know what references to God's organs mean. As soon as I read them, just like that, I know what they mean. I read of God's arm or his hand, and it's obviously talking about his strength, his powerful activity. I read of God's eyes, and it's obviously talking about his awareness of everything that happens. I read of God's ear, and it's obviously talking about his attentiveness to his people's cries. I don't have to puzzle over those references. I don't have to put my brain into overdrive. It's just intuitive. And that's not because when I was at theological college, I did a fancy module on anthropomorphisms or something. That's a word that you hear people throw around. An anthropomorphism, we're told, is when the Bible describes God as though he has human features. But actually, those references to God's organs, they're not anthropomorphisms. They're just standard metaphors that you and I use every day. If someone on the news talks about the police using strong arm tactics in a certain situation, that has little to do with the police officer's actual arms. It just means that they're being forceful and aggressive. If a sports headline refers to Manchester City suffering a humiliating cup exit at the hands of Newcastle United last Wednesday, that has nothing to do with actual hands. The players use their feet, not their hands, apart from the goalkeeper. It just means that they did it. They inflicted the cup exit. If a cabinet minister says the government is keeping its eye on the unfolding situation in Ukraine, it doesn't mean that there's some enormous eyeball protruding out of Westminster and trained towards Eastern Europe. It just means the government is aware of what's going on. As I say, physical organs are standard metaphors. They are deeply embedded in the way that we use language. It's utterly natural to interpret this body part or that body part as shorthand for something else. And so we do it with God's body parts when we're reading the Bible. But the same isn't true of emotions. Emotions don't work in human language the same way physical organs do. They aren't shorthand for other things. It doesn't matter whether it's a news headline or a Shakespeare play or a football commentator. Words like sad and happy and angry and disappointed, they don't refer metaphorically to something else. They refer straightforwardly to sadness, happiness, anger, disappointment. And so I come then to a Bible verse, and it speaks of God feeling a particular emotion. And I'm told by that article in Evangelical Times that it can't refer straightforwardly to that emotion because God is emotionless. Well, suddenly I'm lost. I'm clueless as to what that verse is saying. Nothing in a lifetime of using language has prepared me for a situation where an emotion actually means something other than an emotion. Where am I to go to find the meaning for that verse? I'll give you an example. Judges chapter 10, verses 6 and 7. And this is what we read. It's fairly typical Judges kind of material. Judges chapter 10, verse 6. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, and the gods of the Philistines. And they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. Verse 7, so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of the Philistines and into the hand of the Ammonites. Now, what does the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel mean? In a theological universe where God doesn't respond emotionally to situations. Well, your guess is as good as mine. actually the article touches on God's wrath, it says this. It says, God's wrath doesn't fluctuate. Well, if it's kindled in Judges 10, that sure sounds like a bit of fluctuation to me. It's the settled opposition of his holy nature against everything evil. Now, maybe I'm missing something here, but as far as I can see, Judges 10, 6 and 7 permit one interpretation and one only. God saw Israel's idolatry at this particular historical moment, and it aroused his anger. Simple as that. And what about all the texts that speak of God's compassion? Again, if it can't really be compassion because that's incompatible with God's nature, then what the dickens is it? I don't know of any other way of interpreting compassion than as compassion. I'm suddenly groping in the dark. And you see what's happening here then? A gap is opening up between how God describes himself and what God is really like. He describes himself in terms of his anger being kindled and in terms of being moved with compassion, but he's really a God whose changelessness excludes angry or compassionate responses. There's a divorce, I'm saying. There's a chasm between God himself and the revelation he has given. And this is one of the reasons, then, I said the article is dangerously wrong. When, as Christians, we start to read the Bible as a kind of ladybird book on God, or a God for Dummies handbook, a book that patronizes us and fobs us off, telling us about divine emotions that don't really exist, rather than actually unveiling God to us, that's a profoundly unhealthy place to be. And what can happen is, once we've done away with God's emotions, we then move on to other things in the Bible that, like his emotions, similarly depict God as a warm and personal being. And we say, well, those can't be taken literally either. And eventually what we end up with is an utterly dull, utterly drab shell of a God. Listen to the great Benjamin Warfield. He says, men tell us that God is incapable of passion, incapable of being moved from without, that he dwells in holy calm and unchangeable blessedness, untouched by human sufferings or human sorrows forever. Let us bless our God, Warfield says, that it is not true. God can feel. He then asks, but is not this gross anthropomorphism? In other words, by talking about God being emotional, aren't we just creating a God in our own image, idolatrously dressing him up in human features? Is not this gross anthropomorphism? Warfield continues, we are careless of names. It is the truth of God. And we decline to yield up the God of the Bible and the God of our hearts to any philosophical abstraction. He's saying that's what your God eventually becomes once you start dispensing with those things that make him a personal being, things like emotions. Eventually he becomes just a philosophical abstraction, a notion, a concept, a force, an energy. Indeed, listen to Warfield's final sentence. He says, in order to escape an anthropomorphic God, and that's what the article in Evangelical Times is trying to do, get away from the idea that God is like us, only bigger. In order to escape an anthropomorphic God, we must not throw ourselves at the feet of a zoomorphic one, that is a God who's just like an unfeeling animal, or an amorphic one. Amorphic means God's not like anything, actually, because he has no meaningful existence. He's just a void. Just an empty nothingness. That's the trajectory you're on when you start tampering with God's emotions. So, believer, don't go there. Don't go there. In this book that you're holding in your hands this morning, God hasn't hidden himself behind all these misleading descriptions about his anger being kindled and his compassion being aroused and that kind of thing. He hasn't muddied the waters by portraying himself with these emotions that we can't actually take at face value. What we encounter here in this book isn't a poetic representation of God. No, what we encounter here is God. The God of the Bible and the God who actually exists are one and the same thing. In these pages, he offers a genuine revelation of himself. Trust that revelation, believer. Don't allow articles in Evangelical Times to knock your confidence in it. Trust this revelation. View God in this book. He is what he reveals himself to be here. That is a crucial thing, and that is a wonderful, wonderful thing. The Bible offers a genuine revelation. Secondly, this morning, the Christian experiences a genuine compassion. The Christian experiences a genuine compassion. Now, I know I've already mentioned compassion, but I want to dwell on it further because I think the second most disturbing thing about the view propounded in the article, I'll come to the most disturbing thing in a bit, the second most disturbing thing is that you lose the compassion of God for his people. The article itself never mentions God's compassion, but you must lose it. You must lose it. Because compassion is pure emotion. There's nothing else to compassion. It's just an emotion from beginning to end. Love isn't. Love has other dimensions as well as emotion. Love involves the will. Love involves action. So if someone says then, God's love is an emotionless love. It's all about will and action. I think that's wrong, but it's not quite irrational nonsense because, as I say, love does involve will and action. The idea, however, of emotionless compassion, that is irrational nonsense. It's an oxymoron. You can't have emotionless compassion because compassion, I'm saying, is an emotion. It's nothing more, it's nothing less. You watch a news bulletin about people suffering in some disaster on the other side of the world, and great tears run down your cheek as you sit there on the sofa. That's compassion. It doesn't become compassion when you subsequently get off the sofa and make a bank transfer to the relevant charity or book a flight to the affected region. No, that pitying impulse itself, that bare feeling without anything else added to it, that is compassion, because compassion is pure emotion. Which means then that a non-emotional God, a God who doesn't respond to situations emotionally, can't have compassion. It's simple as that. There's no way around that. Either God responds emotionally to situations in his creation, or God is a stranger to compassion. And if God is a stranger to compassion, I don't think I know what Christianity is anymore. I can't conceive of the Christian life minus the compassion of God. It keeps me going. There's barely a day when I don't contemplate God's compassion. Aren't you the same? Doesn't God's compassion mean everything to you? The extraordinary reality that even our stupidly self-inflicted miseries, the miseries and messes that we've gotten ourselves into through foolishness and sin, even those arouse his compassion. Hosea chapter 11. Verse 7, you all know it, I'm sure. My people are bent on turning away from me. And though they call out to the Most High, he shall not raise them up at all. So they're in a mess, the people of Israel at this time. And they're in a mess because of their own determination to turn away from God. And so, of course, as he says there, when they call out to him, he won't do anything. He won't raise them up at all. Why would he? But then suddenly you have verse 8. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm is kindled again and tender. Wow. Well, Luke 15. And there's that lad traipsing back from the far country. And he's a sorry sight, emaciated from hunger, stinking of the pig farm where he's been working. But he's no one to blame for it all but himself. He ran off from his father. And surely then, this father, who of course represents God, can harbour only resentment and disdain for this returning lad. But no. Jesus hasn't read the article in ET. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion. Wow. This son is reaping what he has sown, and yet his very reaping of what he has sown elicits compassion. So there's the extraordinary reality that even our stupidly self-inflicted miseries arouse God's compassion. And then there's the reality that our sufferings and infirmities more generally do. It's one of the brightest stars, isn't it, in the entire galaxy of biblical texts. Psalm 103, from which we sang a few minutes ago. Verses 13 and 14. As a father shows compassion to his children, so the Lord shows compassion to those who fear him. For he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. Perhaps this morning you're struggling with getting older. The way in which everything is a mountain to climb these days. Everything's exhausting. Everything's a slog. Battling with an increasingly recalcitrant body. You look back so wistfully, perhaps, on your more youthful days when you just seemed to have so much energy to do things. Verse 14 there is saying God understands. He understands that we have a constitution of flimsy dust which wears out after 70 or 80 years. He gets that. He appreciates the issue. That's what verse 14 is saying. Verse 13 is saying it arouses his compassion. He feels for you this morning, trying to live your life with a body of dust that's falling apart. He's moved. I'm saying I'm not going to let anyone take the truth of God's compassion from me. It's too precious. I can't face tomorrow if my God is not the God of Hosea 11 and Luke 15 and Psalm 103. But he is. He is. Charles Hodge, like his younger contemporary and countryman Benjamin Warfield, couldn't abide the idea of an emotionless God. And in that connection, he comments on that text in Psalm 103, and he says this. He says, "The scriptures do not mock us when they say, like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him." The scriptures do not mock us. So understand, believer, the Christian experiences a genuine compassion. We all know, don't we, those early chapters of the book of Exodus. They were the theme of the Holiday Bible Club a few weeks ago. And we know that one of the great themes of the early chapters of Exodus is God hearing the groans of the enslaved Israelites, God's compassion, in a word. But actually, if you want to know the intensity of that compassion of God's for the enslaved Israelites, there's a better place to go than the early chapters of Exodus. It's Isaiah 63, verse 9. It's surely one of the most remarkable verses in Scripture. This is how that verse describes the effect of Israel's cruel bondage on God. "In all their afflictions, he was afflicted." In all their afflictions, he was afflicted. In 1992, Bill Clinton was the Democratic presidential candidate, and he was on the campaign trail, and at one of his rallies, there was a heckler. I'm not sure what exactly the heckler said. You can't very easily pick it up on the video footage, but he was complaining about some injustice or other. And Clinton responded directly to this guy. And whatever you might think of Bill Clinton, he actually handled this heckler very well. He was firm with him, rebuking him in no uncertain terms for his incivility in disrupting the rally like that. But he was also sympathetic regarding the issue which the heckler had raised. And in that connection, he uttered four words which would subsequently become an established phrase in the English-speaking world. I feel your pain. I feel your pain. And Isaiah 63 verse 9 is saying God was so moved by his people's plight in Egypt that in some sense he felt their pain. In some sense their pain became God's pain too. Wow. Wow, this compassion in the heart of God is something else. Believe it, Christian. Believe it. Believe that in your griefs and distresses, a genuine compassion flows out to you from the depths of God. You will realize it one day. On that day when you finally meet him and the first thing that he does, according to three biblical texts, is run to you and gently wipe away every tear from your eyes, you'll realize then that his is a genuine compassion. Believe it now, I'm saying, and derive from it now splendid comfort amidst your troubles. So we've seen two things then. The Bible offers a genuine revelation. The Christian experiences a genuine compassion. But then thirdly and finally, the Father makes a genuine sacrifice. The Father makes a genuine sacrifice. I said I would come to the most disturbing thing about the article. And I think the most disturbing thing about the article is when it refers to someone erroneously, it says, that means wrongly, suggesting that the Father suffered through the cross. So in the view of the author of the article then, the Father did not suffer through the cross. At the cross, the Son suffered because he has a human nature. He bore all the cost. The entire cost of our salvation, he bore it all. The Father, on the other hand, he's unsuffering at Calvary. He's having a blast while all that is going on that middle cross. Which raises the question, why then does the New Testament stress the cross as the emphatic demonstration of the Father's sacrificial love? Yes, it points to the cross as the demonstration of Christ's love. He loved me and gave himself for me. But it also points to the cross as the emphatic demonstration of the Father's sacrificial love. God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, John 3:16. He did not spare his own Son, but gave him up for us all, we read earlier in Romans 8, 32. But if giving up his Son didn't really hurt and pain the Father, then how on earth is it the emphatic demonstration of his sacrificial love? Put it this way. How in that case is it any different to him giving you and me daily bread? We know he gives us daily bread. We mention it every time we utter the Lord's Prayer. Now, we have no right, do we, either to daily bread or to the death of God's Son. The giving of both those things, daily bread, the death of the Son on the cross, the giving of both these things is clearly gracious and benevolent. But how is the latter at all superior to the former? How is the latter, the giving of the Son at Calvary, how is that God's inexpressible gift or indescribable gift at 2 Corinthians 9:15? How is the gift of the Son at the cross a superior gift to the gift of daily food? That's what I'm asking. Well, I suppose we could say it achieves more for us. Daily bread achieves temporal survival. The death of God's Son on the cross achieves eternal safety. But if you're coming at things from the perspective of that article, that really is the only difference. God's Son given at the cross is a more useful and effective gift because of what it secures for us, but it's not a more sacrificial gift. It's no more sacrificial than daily bread is. Because being sacrificial is about incurring pain. That's the meaning of being sacrificial. But if the Father can't suffer, he can't incur pain. And so it's no more painful for him to give his Son to me than it was for him to give me my muesli at breakfast time this morning. I'm saying these texts, John 3:16, Romans 8:32, they only have any force if the Father did indeed suffer through the cross. He didn't suffer nails through his hands. He didn't suffer in the same way that the Son suffered. But the Father suffered because he was giving up, those texts say, his Son. It's interesting, isn't it? The additional adjectives that those texts use. God so loved the world that he gave his only Son. He did not spare his own Son. Surely those all have as their background an Old Testament narrative, the story of Abraham and Isaac in Genesis 22. God's call to Abraham, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. And when John or Jesus in John 3:16 and Paul in Romans 8, when they echo that language, they must be saying that at the cross we have the Abraham and Isaac story replaying only on a vastly grander scale. Now, you read Genesis 22. With whom does every reader of that story relate? To which character are you drawn? It's Abraham, isn't it? Isaac hardly features in the narrative. He doesn't seem to understand what's going on. But Abraham, he knows what's going on. And there he is, having to walk those 3 days, carrying in his hand the knife with which he knows he's going to have to slay his precious, beloved son. What a painful sacrifice Abraham is making. And that's how we're meant to feel when we come to the cross. Yes, as we look at the one on the altar, the Son, Jesus Christ, what a painful sacrifice he is making. But also as we look at the other involved, the Father with the knife in his hand at Golgotha, doing something so unnatural and counterintuitive and unprecedented throughout that eternal relationship he's had with his Son. Wow, what a painful sacrifice he is making. And so, reflect on that, believer. Reflect on it as we come in just a moment to this table in front of us. This is why you can be so sure that one day God will give you your eternal inheritance. That's actually what Paul is going on about in Romans 8. We read that passage, and the whole context there is eternal glory, isn't it? It's resurrection, the glory that's going to be revealed. And remember how he gets to the end of verse 30, and he has that list: predestined, called, justified, glorified. Same past tense as the other things, but Paul, you're grammatically incorrect there, we feel like saying. We haven't been glorified yet. But he uses the past tense, as you all know, because he's so sure it's going to happen. Now, here's the question. How are you so sure, Paul, that it's going to happen? And that's why he goes on to say in verse 32, he who did not spare his own son, won't he give us everything else as well? He doesn't mean give us health and wealth in this life. He means he will give us this future glory that I've just been talking about over the preceding verses. His point is that if the Father was going to pull back at any point, if he was going to withhold something from us, it would be at Calvary. Because there he had to sacrifice. There he had to incur pain. There he had to suffer a broken heart. But the fact he didn't pull back at that point, well, it's easy compared to that to give us future glory. It's nothing. We began this morning with Charles Spurgeon. Let's end too with Charles Spurgeon. And this is from a different sermon, and it's a communion sermon, so fitting for us as we come to the Lord's table now. And this is what he says. He says, "Perhaps you have a willful, wayward boy." I'm sure that applies to none of you this morning. "Perhaps you have a willful, wayward boy, one who costs you much but brings you little comfort. Yet would you like to lose him? If you saw him in his coffin tomorrow, would you not cry over him as David cried over his son? Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for you, oh Absalom, my son. Vile he may be, and a disgrace to your name, yet he is still your child, and you could not bear to give him up. But what shall I say of the child who, from his youth up, has been obedient to you, who, having grown up to manhood, has become your friend as well as your offspring, who has been with you in every enterprise and has proved himself worthy of his father's love and esteem? Could you give him up? To lose one's child is pain and grief indeed. Then what must it have cost God to give up his son, to die for his people?" Theologians lay it down as an axiom, the same language used in the other sermon. Theologians lay it down as an axiom that God cannot suffer. But I am not sure that they are right. I cannot rejoice as I should in his goodness to me unless I believe that the gift of his son cost his heart awful pangs. I cannot think of God as an insensible being when he gave his son to die for sinners. I cannot imagine him giving his only begotten son and feeling no more than a heathen idol of stone could have done. I think that the Father, in giving up that son who had always given him such intense joy, must have suffered in his son's death. On that note, let's come to the Lord's table.